From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As we approached the new year and the prospect of a few days off, we decided to prepare a show in advance about books. Not the book industry. We did that to get time off on Thanksgiving. This is about some actual recent books, some of which we've already discussed on the show, that you might want to consider.
For instance, the candidate book, the one surefire way a presidential aspirant can deliver their message directly to the voters, unmediated by pundits or the press. By our count, there are a total of at least 35 written works, either penned or compiled by the current crop of would-be nominees. And I trust you've read them all. Emily Heil has cracked more than her share. She's a reporter for the Washington-based newspaper Roll Call, where she writes the Heard on the Hill column. Emily, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be here, Brooke. Thanks for having me.
Now, I get that every candidate has to have a website and a YouTube video, but why do they all need to be authors, too?
Writing a book is one of the few opportunities they really have to communicate in this very full way. Most of them really think they have something to say, and most of it they think can't be condensed into a bullet point or, you know, a soundbite. This is a chance for them to step into the role that they want everyone to see them in. So, for example, for John Edwards, that's as a trial attorney, a really crusading trial attorney on behalf of the poor.
And I should say his book, Four Trials, is an account of four cases he worked on during his career as a trial lawyer.
Yes. What struck me about Edwards' book, Four Trials, is in that the first passage describes him speaking to his client, who can't himself speak. He's typing words onto a keyboard to communicate. And the message that Edwards seems to be sending is the message to voters that I will speak for you in the same way that I spoke for this client. I will speak for those who can't speak for themselves. And he's not that explicit about it, but I think that's the message he's really trying to send to readers.
Campaigning by metaphor, something you can only do through a book.
Yeah, that doesn't work so well in the 60-second ads.
When we think of a candidate book, most of us, at least of a certain age, begin with JFK's Profiles in Courage. It wasn't a memoir. It wasn't a sort of explication on a resume. It wasn't about a personal journey at all, or at least not about his.
No, but I think that Profiles in Courage is really the template that so many candidates aspire to, in that it was a chance for a young senator to show himself, even though he didn't do it directly through himself. You know, Senator John McCain has done something like this. His most recent book, Hard Call, mimics the Profiles in Courage template, where he profiles people who've made difficult decisions. And in doing so, he casts himself as an arbiter in the same way that Senator Kennedy did, cast himself as an arbiter of courage. And in this way, Senator McCain is saying, you know, it takes one to know one.
Let's talk about people, though, who have had long careers and multiple books like McCain. Let's begin with Hillary, who wrote or had ghostwritten for her, depending on who you believe, two books. One in 1996 was a volume on children called It Takes a Village. And the second one, written in 2003, a reflection on her experiences as First Lady, called Living History. What do we find out here about how she changed between those two volumes?
I think It Takes a Village is very much a policy tome. In that zone, she is much more comfortable than, say, in Living History, where she's perhaps a little warier and a little more self-aware. But there are some very interesting things in Living History that do speak to her as a person. Most notably for me, it was an explanation of her relationship with her husband, of course, former President Bill Clinton. You really do see that they share this very strong bond, and it shows how it was forged in the early years of their courtship and their marriage. It's often seen as a marriage of convenience or a political pact, but Living History gave you a peek behind that sort of facade.
Now, Barack Obama also has two books in print, his personal memoir called Dreams from My Father, which was written in 1995, well before his Senate run, much less his presidential run, and then the bestseller, The Audacity of Hope, which was released just last year. Of all the candidate authors, he's reputed to be the most talented writer.
Absolutely. I think that you're right. Dreams from My Father is a very personal story. It's a story of a journey. The Audacity of Hope is more a politician looking to show the world what he's about. If you don't mind, I'd like to read a passage from Dreams from My Father that I think illustrates his writerly sensibility.
Please.
He's talking about traveling through Europe as a young man. He's on his way to Kenya, where he hopes to learn more about his father. He writes, "I felt as if I were living out someone else's romance. The incompleteness of my own history stood between me and the sights I saw like a hard pane of glass." I really do think that's quite beautiful writing.
Romney's book, Turnaround, is about his leadership. Giuliani's book, which is called Leadership, is about his turnaround of New York. Are these basically the same book?
Mitt Romney's almost reads like an MBA casebook. He describes in very loving detail a deal that he works out to get office supplies for the Salt Lake City Olympics. And this goes on for a number of paragraphs.
Sounds gripping.
Yes. And so he casts himself in that sort of boardroom warrior role that I think he really wants to show on the campaign trail as well. Now, Giuliani's book, Leadership, it's almost like a how-to book as opposed to Romney's case study. You know, he's prescribing steps that people should take to be better leaders, things like have beliefs and communicate them. One thing I thought was very interesting about Giuliani's book is that one of his prescriptions for being a good leader is to surround yourself with good people.
Uh-oh.
In retrospect, it's interesting, given what we know about folks like Bernie Kerik.
His former police chief that has been accused of ties with organized crime.
Exactly. So in some ways, a candidate's book can come back to haunt them when hindsight makes some of their writing maybe more interesting than they meant it to be.
Emily, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks. So glad to be here, Brooke.
Emily Heil writes the Heard on the Hill column for Roll Call. If you classify candidate books as nonfiction, and I think we're supposed to, then you can assume that Time magazine columnist Michael Kinsley would not be thrilled by their proliferation. In an essay he wrote a few years back, he took a strong stand against nonfiction. He wrote, quote, "There's too much nonfiction going on in the world already without writers adding to it."
Well, that was in a way a joke, but you and I both know people who are writing big, long nonfiction books more because they want to have written a book than any desire to write this actual book. And it drags them down into years of misery. And, you know, they look pale. They've taken leaves from their jobs and don't have enough money. And this is all to produce something which some people may buy, maybe even a lot of people may buy, somewhat fewer people will read. You know, sometimes you do think, what's the point?
Right, but it's not just nonfiction that does this to authors.
Well, part of it is I am in awe of people who write fiction, especially people who write it successfully, because I can't imagine doing it myself. So I respect that.
The corollary being that you don't respect so much.
Well, as I was saying that, I realized I was giving you that opening. Sure, I respect anyone who tackles a book, but there's a mystery to me in writing fiction that impresses me more. Second, there's a lot of nonfiction in the world already. I mean, we spend our lives living in nonfiction.
Could you tell us about the experiment you conducted a few years ago with the best-selling nonfiction books?
Yeah, this was many years ago, and the leading bookstore in Washington was Olson's. I went in there with some Post-it notes. And I had someone else did it, too. And we put them about three-quarters of the way through maybe 50 books, say half a dozen titles, 10 each. And it said, if you see this, call Mike Kinsley at the New Republic, where I was then working, and you'll get $5. And nobody called.
Now, you could say that $5 just wasn't enough incentive.
This was long enough ago that $5 could buy a book, for example. you know, it wasn't scientific, and it was basically for fun. But I was shocked that not a single person ever called. And actually, there's a particular kind of nonfiction that, to me, is more likely to be a puzzle, which is the Washington Policy Book, or the memoir of the press secretary of the president before last. They market the book on the basis of these quotes, you know, or little scooplets.
That are placed in newspapers in advance of the publication?
Right, right. So you can read virtually everything that the publisher thinks is of value in the book in the newspaper. So why do you buy the book? And it has something to do with its icon value. You know, it's having this book that is in the newspapers. I do it too every now and then, but it's peculiar.
Do you blame publishers for there being too much nonfiction, or authors, or people like you who might buy a book you really don't think you'll ever open?
I'm not sure I blame anyone. I mean, publishers want to make money. Writers want to see their name on a book. You know, to be frank, and also to give myself a plug, I've got a book coming out in 2 or 3 months, and it's just a collection of columns, so there was nothing urgent that I had to say. And they paid me practically nothing for it, so I didn't do it for the money. I did it for vanity.
But when nobody's looking, don't you secretly thrill to read the latest nonfiction wonder book?
Well, I thrilled to buy it, or even or even better, in our business, Brooke, you get an amazing number of them for free. And I certainly thrilled to that. There's many satisfactions you get from reading books. But thrill, I can't remember the last time I got an actual thrill out of a nonfiction book.
Michael, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Brooke.
Michael Kinsley is a regular columnist for Time magazine.
For the American press, it was the biggest story hidden in plain sight, the injustice of segregation. But in the 50s, the civil rights movement finally forced this story onto the front page, reported by those who David Halberstam called war correspondents on native soil. Gene Roberts was one of them. A cub reporter in his native South, he went on to be the executive editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer and managing editor of the New York Times. Earlier this year, we spoke to him about his book, The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation. It begins with a portrait of one of the sharpest scribes ever to work on The Race Beat, a Swedish scholar named Gunnar Myrdal, hired by the Carnegie Foundation in the 1930s to write a study of race in America.
To this day, it is probably the most comprehensive study of race in America ever done. The Supreme Court used it as a footnote in the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954. The most important finding was that the press wasn't covering the story, particularly the Northern press, and he felt that if the press ever started writing about the problems of segregation, that the nation would be so offended that it would demand change. And that's exactly what happened.
Tell me about Emmett Till, the death of Emmett Till, and how that incident helped open up the ugliness for the whole world.
Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black boy who had grown up in Chicago and had relatives in Mississippi, and was sent back for a summer. He and some other black kids were in a small town store one day, and the white woman proprietress claimed that Emmett Till had whistled at her. He was later found in a river with a cotton gin fan around his neck. He had been badly beaten and shot. And when his body arrived in Chicago, his mother insisted on opening the casket, allowing photographers to photograph it. The outcry was enormous. an all-white jury acquitted the defendants. And when the trial occurred, you had, for the first time, a large number of northern white reporters coming in to cover a racial incident. And you had a turning point.
On the heels of Emmett Till was the Montgomery bus boycott and Rosa Parks' famous refusal to move to the back of the bus. Tell me the effect of the juxtaposition of these two events.
There were four events over about a two-year period. The Emmett Till case, the Montgomery bus boycott, the attempted desegregation of the University of Alabama, and the Little Rock desegregation effort. And from this time on, the coverage of segregation was a major national story.
It's sometimes surprising to recall that things like the Montgomery bus boycott didn't happen spontaneously, but because the organizers, including Rosa Parks, knew that they would get a lot of national coverage and generate a lot of outrage.
The civil rights movement, the leaders became serious students of the American press and would pick target communities in which they thought the sheriff or the police chief was most likely to be violent and produce the kind of television and newspaper photographic images that would grab national attention, which is what led Martin Luther King both to Birmingham and to Selma, Alabama. It was so violent and so dramatic that it galvanized the nation and led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
You describe a meeting in 1959, Southern editors getting together in a secret meeting to fight the influence of the Northern press.
They met in an Atlanta hotel and decided that they would harass the Associated Press. And for several weeks thereafter, these newspapers would hear about a routine crime story in the North and say, what were the race of the people involved? Why don't we get comparable coverage of this to the way you cover race in the South? And they generally tried to drive the Associated Press officials in New York crazy. It was a serious attempt to divert attention away from the South.
In the mid-60s, after the Watts riots in Los Angeles and with the rise of the Black Power movement, the tone and tenor of the coverage of the civil rights movement, you say, began to noticeably change. Why?
The initial riots tended to be more Western and Northern, and the Black Power movement tended to be suspicious, sometimes hostile to the press, whereas the conventional civil rights movement had cultivated the press. People like me who were covering the civil rights movement in the South, when I felt threatened in a Southern town, I automatically moved into the Black community for protection and to use the telephones. And suddenly I was covering riots in the North, fleeing out of a Black community into the white community for protection.
I'm glad you mentioned how your tactics changed. You're right in the thick of things, and you've had a storied career. But I get the feeling from reading your book that this is the one story that you can't quite shake.
I thought that tensions ran so high in the South that real change wouldn't occur. I went to cover Martin Luther King in Durham, and I expected his audience to be mainly student protesters. But when I arrived at the church, all the students were outside because older blacks had come hours early to make sure they got seats. And many middle-aged and elderly ladies who made up the audience reached in their pocketbooks and pulled out their handkerchiefs in which they had put their nickels and dimes. And they began opening their handkerchiefs to contribute. for the first time that night, I became convinced that there was going to be major racial change in the South. And while I went on later to cover the Vietnam War and the Kennedy assassination, among other things, the civil rights story is still the most important story, certainly, of the 20th century.
Gene, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Gene Roberts, former executive editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer and managing editor of the New York Times, is the co-author of The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation.
For in me, even in Jesus the Christ, is the solution for all your problems, the haven of rest for every storm-tossed soul, the pillow of comfort for every weary head.
That is the voice of one of radio's true pioneers, though for her, it was just a means to an end. Amy Semple McPherson was most famous for her personal brand of thrilling, seductive Pentecostal evangelism. Back nearly a century ago, when the electronic media was just being born, McPherson already was the model of the modern self-made media sensation. She'd established her reputation for faith healing and sermonizing on the tent revival circuit, but it's when she set down roots in Los Angeles in the early 1920s that her holy rolling really hit its stride. Matthew Avery Sutton is the author of the book Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America, released earlier this year. He told us back in April that for every Los Angelino drawn to her church, there was an unsuspecting future congregant first captivated by her voice on the radio.
Radio was one of the first things she embraced in terms of the new technology of the 1920s. She actually claimed to be the first woman to preach on radio, although she probably was not. Once she settles in Los Angeles, she decides she wants her own radio station. And so she's able to build a state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line station, which opened in February of 1924. And it was one of the most powerful early stations in the Western United States. Even there are some reports that it might have been picked up in Australia. You could hear her north into Canada and south into Mexico. And so this just had a tremendous influence.
Didn't she have a faith healing show where she invited listeners to put their hands on the radio to be healed by her prayers?
She did. In the early years, one of the things that really catapulted her into the national spotlight was she had this remarkable ability to lay hands on people, pray for them, and many of them were seemingly healed. And so she transferred this into radio by once again saying that she believed the Holy Spirit had told her that there was somebody out there who needed to be healed of a particular affliction. And then she would say, you know, whoever you are, wherever you are, put your hands on your radio and let the power of the Spirit flow through the radio to you. And so people would actually do this. And it was very much a precursor to some of the things that televangelists have done in more recent years.
She brought her style of tent revivals to her church. What could people expect when they went into her church?
McPherson's church was the most exciting place to be on a Sunday night. It had 5,300 mahogany opera chairs. There was a center stage. There was a giant orchestra. She had a beautiful choir. And every Sunday night, she actually had an elaborate set designed and constructed. She had top-of-the-line lighting. And then she would reenact with a whole series of actors different biblical stories.
They always say, never use children or animals. Did she?
She did, yeah. She always had children up there. She had sheep in the church. She had dogs. She would also use animals outside of the church, at one time posing with camels, another time posing with a lion from the LA Zoo. And she was able to use her connections with the movie studios to use the trained animals that were also being used by the film industry. This was the best show in town, and it was free.
She wasn't just out there collecting parishioners. She was also assembling the media elite.
One of the things that Amy had learned while she was on the road before she gets to Los Angeles is how important it was to have sympathetic press. So when she sets up in LA, right away she hires a public relations manager and she hires publicity experts. And every day she obliges the press with different candid photographs or with a quote. She has coffee ready for them every day, which apparently a lot of the movie studios gave out whiskey. And so McPherson countered that with her coffee to try and sober up the reporters.
So that brings us to the nascent film industry in Hollywood. She wanted to create what she called talky sermons. But there were other people who advised her to stay away because, for instance, the Hollywood movie industry was run by Jews.
Yeah, film was really controversial. Part of it was the anti-Semitism in the fundamentalist movement and the Pentecostal movement. Part of it also was just seeing Hollywood as very secular, as very immoral, as sensationalizing and sexualizing. But McPherson, especially once film went to the talkies, she believed this had the potential to revolutionize religious faith in the United States. And so she wanted to jump into that. And so right away, she incorporated a film company and she began working with the best and biggest producers in Hollywood to try to create a film based on her own life.
And how did that work out?
It actually didn't. And I didn't really know why when I was just in the archives reading the written sources until I actually saw the footage that remains of her. And she's not very comfortable on camera. She was so good on the stage. She was so good on the radio. But on film, she looks a little awkward, not quite sure where to look or what to do. And so the film projects eventually fizzled. The camera just didn't love her.
On the other hand, the camera seemed to love depictions of her created by other people.
Yeah. McPherson's techniques, her use of media, her flamboyance raised a lot of controversies. And so many people thought she was a charlatan. And there were also rumors of sexual improprieties. And so other Hollywood films sensationalized this. Frank Capra did The Miracle Woman in 1931, starring Barbara Stanwyck, which was based on McPherson.
You want to know why I'm going away? Because I'm a fake. And all those people that tell about the good things I've done, they're fakes, too. They're paid to testify. It's lies, all lies. I'm not going away. I'm running away.
What from?
From all those people I've robbed and cheated. Those people that think I perform miracles. Miracles.
Elmer Gantry was made in the 1960s, obviously based on the novel, and both the novel and the film were based on McPherson.
Now, an incident in 1926 would change her life and the steady growth of the church. Tell us briefly about her abduction and how she framed it.
One afternoon in the spring of 1926, McPherson had gone swimming. She'd gone down to the beach with an assistant. At one point, the assistant looked up and the evangelist had just vanished. She stayed gone for over a month. Her church members, her mother, her family, they all believed she had died, that she'd probably drowned. Well, suddenly, she reappeared in the border town of Agua Prieta, just south of Douglas, Arizona, with this fantastic tale of kidnapping.
A lot of people thought that was a bunch of hooey, right? That she had actually run off with her radio engineer.
Right. He had actually disappeared at about the same time McPherson did, and it was becoming increasingly clear to the Los Angeles media that he had been in Northern California with a heavily disguised lover. And so the question then became, was McPherson this secret lover? Eventually, this ended up playing out in the Los Angeles courts. And so McPherson was set to go to trial in 1927 until the charges were, at the last minute, dropped.
How did the press treat this trial?
It absolutely captivated the Los Angeles newspapers, which were competing for readers in an era in which LA is doubling in size. But it also got the attention of the national papers. The New York Times did almost 100 articles on the kidnapping over the course of 1926, which was roughly the same number of articles it had done on the Scopes trial,
incredible,
to give you a sense of comparison. And the national magazines all picked up the story, Vanity Fair, The New Republic, The Nation.
And yet, by the early 30s, she had rehabilitated her image somewhat. She was a provider of free meals during the Depression, and she was a strident voice against communism and fascism. Didn't that help?
It did. She seems to regain her footing in the early to mid-30s. Part of it was the Depression. She had always been interested in social welfare work, but she also recognized that her efforts to become a Hollywood star had failed, that the media had turned on her. And so what she does is she really returns to her Pentecostal roots. She begins bringing African-Americans into her church and preaching side by side with them. She begins emphasizing women's rights again. And she begins embracing the more controversial practices of Pentecostalism, things like speaking in tongues that she had downplayed in her early years because she knew you don't want people speaking in tongues on the radio or everybody's going to think you're crazy. But by the late 30s, she didn't care so much anymore.
You suggest that one of her greatest innovations, the one that stays with us today, is to equate evangelicalism with patriotism.
McPherson really came to believe that in the same way that God had chosen the Middle East for the birth of Christ, she believed that God had chosen the United States for this last final revival before the apocalypse. And so for her, this meant it was as important as anything to make sure that America maintained what she saw as its Christian foundations. And she really encourages Pentecostals for the first time who had been focused on otherworldly issues to make sure and bear down and get involved in the rough and tumble world of American political life. And with that then came this sense of nationalism, this idea that was God's will for American Christians to take their message and to spread it throughout the rest of the globe.
Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Matthew Sutton is the author of Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America.
My precious Lord,
my precious Lord,
has won my heart,
has won my heart,
and never from,
and never from,
him will I part.
Coming up, the gun heard round the world.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The stereotype of journalists makes us all seem like electrons, lightweight, inherently negative, and easily spun. Pfft, ridiculous. Some of us are quite heavy set. The negativity thing, though, is pretty much dead on. We are, as a group, by definition, in the misery business. War, poverty, crime, corruption, natural disaster, the Spears family. Wherever something goes horribly awry, we show up in force. Two wrongs don't make a right, but they make a fabulous front page. Enter then Eric Weiner. For two decades, NPR's most accurately named correspondent has crossed the globe for stories that will ruin your breakfast. He doesn't himself create misery, but he's a carrier, and this began to get to him. He'd become so used to documenting unhappiness that he feared for his own. So he packed his bags and off he went to Switzerland and Bhutan, Iceland and Thailand, India and Miami Beach, not in search of misery, but of happiness. The resulting book, titled The Geography of Bliss, is out next month, and it is charming and wonderful, but more to the point, proof positive that there is more to journalism than body counts. We couldn't invite Eric on the program, although we've never met him, because he's out hustling a book, and God forbid he get a plug on more than one NPR weekend show. By comparison, Yahoo's Kevin Seitz traveled to war zones in 20 countries, and we had him on twice.
Of all the weapons in the vast Soviet arsenal, nothing was more profitable than Avtomat Kalashnikova, model of 1947, more commonly known as the AK-47 or Kalashnikov.
It's the That's actor Nicolas Cage as arms dealer Yuri Orlov in the 2005 movie Lord of War.
It doesn't break, jam, or overheat. It will shoot whether it's covered in mud or filled with sand. It's so easy, even a child can use it, and they do.
In the 60 years since Mikhail Kalashnikov created the AK-47, it has become the most popular assault rifle in the world. As Orlov noted in the film, the Soviets emblazoned it on a coin, and the nation of Mozambique on its flag to celebrate the gun's role in overthrowing Portuguese colonials. Russian President Vladimir Putin himself at a ceremony said this year, quote, "The Kalashnikov rifle is a symbol of the creative genius of our people." Michael Hodges is the author of AK-47, The Story of the People's Gun, published last year by Scepter. When we spoke to him in July, he told us that even the story of the gun's creation was a media invention.
That's right. It first came to the notice of the Russian people in an article in Pravda, where Mikhail Kalashnikov was given as an example of the perfect proletarian, the perfect communist citizen, whose ingenuity had created this weapon that was going to defend the revolution and socialism. So even in 1947, the AK-47 was a creature of the media, I think you could argue.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, how it was actually used, at least in the 50s and 60s, was not to defend one's motherland or fatherland, but to overthrow their leadership. It became the gun of third world revolutionaries.
I think that the key moment in the AK-47's journey from, if you will, the state gun of Soviet communism to the international symbol of a more kind of libertarian idea of revolution, the more 60s countercultural idea of what revolution meant, was Vietnam and certainly the Tet Offensive in 1968, when astonishing footage of Viet Cong soldiers, guys in black pajamas with this incredible distinctive assault rifle with its almost phallic banana magazine curving away underneath it, alerted the world to its imagery and was laden with power. And in the same year, 68, also in the area where the AK-47 would perhaps take on its most sinister imagery eventually, the Israeli army invaded Jordan, a 10,000-strong raiding party to try and crush Fatah, Yasser Arafat's branch of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And although technically they won for the first time, they were held by Palestinian fighters. And Time magazine over there in New York put Arafat for the first time on the cover. And next to him was, as Time put it at the time, a fedayeen, the new Arab guerrilla, holding an AK-47. And that was a key moment, I think, in the AK-47 being perceived throughout the world as the weapon of the underdog.
Before we move back to the Middle East, let's stay in Southeast Asia for the moment. It was noted at the time the American soldiers in Vietnam realized quickly that the AKs they confiscated from dead soldiers worked better than their own M16s.
The M16 was almost over-engineered. I mean, it was, in the sense of its technical superiority, its caliber, its engineering, the best assault rifle in the world. But the jungles of Vietnam didn't require the best assault rifle in the world, they required the toughest. So in the heat and mud of Southeast Asia, the M16 jammed, it rusted, it expanded and didn't shoot, which is kind of important in a battle that your gun shoots. I mean, originally it was American Special Forces, the guys that were dropped behind the lines to look for the Ho Chi Minh Trail, who started taking the enemy gun with them, primarily because they knew they could trust it. But eventually it became quite commonplace for American soldiers in general to pick up AK-47s in the battlefield where they found them.
Tell us how Osama bin Laden first encountered the AK-47.
Well, the story of the AK-47 is rich in irony, but this is perhaps the most ironic episode. I was in Israel in 1982 when the Israelis invaded the Lebanon, primarily to disarm the Palestinian guerrillas there, which they did. And shortly after the invasion, I went to a public park in Israel where on display were thousands and thousands of AK-47s that the Israelis had captured. And in this public park, there was music, there were picnicking families, there was laughter. The imagery of the gun was such that the Palestinian without the AK was a cause for celebration. Those same AK-47s that had been taken were then sent by the CIA and shipped via the Pakistani secret services into Afghanistan, where they were then given to the jihadis who were fighting the Russians there. The first time Osama bin Laden picked up an AK-47, it was quite likely to have been given to him indirectly by the CIA.
And now the gun has become a virtual symbol of international terrorism and jihad, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And in training camps in the Philippines, there are murals on the walls depicting two hands, one holding an AK-47, the other holding the Quran. And the double K of the Quran and the Kalashnikov has become the dual symbol of the jihad across the world.
It's also become a symbol of urban struggle that's made its way into a lot of popular music, especially rap. In fact, we've created a montage.
AK-47, assault rifle, hold the 50, I'm nifty, pow, I got a new style.
Swing an AK, drop 10 grenades, main, sing serenades, we in the streets.
I didn't even have to use my AK, I gotta say it was a good day.
It has a particular appeal, certainly to black, disadvantaged, angry youth, because it's not only cheap and available, but also it carries with it a revolutionary imagery that no other weapon can give them. rock and roll here in England has always been slightly in love with guns, probably because most rock and rollers don't see what guns actually do when they're fired. But the Clash here have had machine guns on their T-shirts, and the Manic Street Preachers have sung about AK-47s. It gives a kind of cheap kudos, a revolutionary danger to rock and roll, which I don't take very seriously, but I think in urban music it should be taken very seriously indeed.
It's also made its way into Hollywood films, from Rambo to Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown. We have an expurgated clip of that.
AK-47, the very best there is. When you absolutely, positively got to kill every motherfucker in the room, except no substitutes.
Tarantino films are cartoonish, and there's a definite lightheartedness about the way violence is portrayed. But Hollywood has been dealing with the AK-47 since America withdrew from the Vietnam War. I guess you guys lost the war, but Hollywood decided you could win the weapon that beat you. Like ink on blotting paper spreading throughout American culture. I think Hollywood acted as an effective propaganda tool and advertising agency for a weapon which they, in retrospect, might regret doing, I think.
Kalashnikov is now 87 years old. He seems to be of two minds about this gun he brought into the world. He told you that sometimes he wishes he'd invented a lawnmower. On the other hand, he said recently that his conscience is clear. You visited with him at his dacha in Russia. What's your impression?
As he sits there in his old age watching the news and sees things like Beslan, the slaughter of the school children there, which was an AK-47 battle primarily, when he sees Osama bin Laden with an AK-47 by his side, eventually these things force him into a position where he feels obliged to defend himself. So though he doesn't feel he's to be blamed, he feels obliged to speak out. When I first met the general, we were sipping vodka, as you do in Russia, he described the AK-47 to me as the golem, which is the mythical creature of Eastern European Yiddish culture. When you take inanimate material, in that case clay, and you invest it with life, and it goes off and does your bidding, but of course in the legend it gets a mind of its own and you can't get it back. And I thought it interesting that the general should call the AK-47 the golem, because that's what it's done. It's long ago slipped out of his control.
Michael, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Brooke. Thank you.
Michael Hodges is the author of AK-47, The Story of the People's Gun, published by Scepter. We'll end this show of books on a work of fiction. In recent years, we've seen many fine nonfiction accounts and analyses of the war in Iraq, and many reporters have put their experiences between hard covers to give us a personal sense of the process, the anecdotes, and the accidents of fate that can save or change a life. But as I said, we'll end this hour on a novel about the war called Last One In, written by Nick Kulish, who in 2003 was embedded with a Marine attack helicopter squadron for the Wall Street Journal. The plot revolves around gossip columnist Jimmy Stevens at the fictional New York Daily Herald, who, through a series of unfortunate events, finds himself on the front line. Publishers Weekly says the book offers a steady flow of Yossarian-flavored absurdity, and in fact, I did catch a taste of Catch-22 in Last One In. This week, we found Nick Kulish in Berlin, where he is the New York Times bureau chief. He says the military clearances and all the red tape involved in getting an embed spot for a reporter in Iraq gave him the setup for his story.
When I was getting ready to go to Iraq, I remember my bureau chief asking me, "Are you sure? Because there are no substitutions. Once we put your name down, we can't send somebody else in your place. What would happen, you know, if our best correspondent were to break his leg tomorrow? We'd just lose our embed spot." And so the great war correspondent for the New York Daily Herald is James E. Stevens, serious personage, big white bushy beard, if you can picture.
Veteran of Mogadishu.
Exactly. Veteran of the Moog and every other, you know, hot spot that you've ever had. And you meet these guys, which is a lot of the inspiration for this. And Jimmy Stevens is the young, slick gossip columnist who knows a lot more about bribing doormen than he does about M16s and helicopters.
But what happens is the great James E. Stevens is hit by a delivery truck, and so the editor decides to send Jimmy Stevens, the disgraced gossip columnist, in the war reporter's place.
Exactly. He needs what you'd call a warm body on the front lines. And I think that that gets a little bit at some of the monomania that arises in these situations. We need someone with the Marines. I don't care who it is. Send the gossip boy. Send the sports guy. Just get us somebody in Basra.
But you also managed to choose as clueless a journalist as you could possibly find. Had you done much war reporting before you were embedded with that Marine attack helicopter unit?
No, I had done none. And I think that that made it easier for me to relate to Jimmy Stevens' experience. He's sort of a grotesque, over-the-top version of a lot of people who were there who were doing this war for beginners version of things. I come from a military family. My father was in the Army for, you know, a full 20 years. And I grew up going to the post exchange for our groceries and things like that. So I was not ignorant of the slang or of the weaponry or things like that. But at the same time, there is this feeling when you're embedded, you're with a group of people who have trained together and probably fought together and who have all of these sort of bonds, and you're just kind of the odd man out looking in.
But you also had a kind of wordsmith's disdain for useless obfuscation. Instead of calling somebody a prisoner of war, they were called an EPW and
right.
An enemy prisoner of war.
I could not get over that one. It was like those acronyms are meant to scare, confuse, and keep us away. And so if the culture at large picks one up, then they go back to the drawing board and try to make one that's even harder to figure out.
You know, the funniest moment in the book is in some ways also the saddest. It's when Jimmy tries to call his editor in New York to beg him to bring him home. But instead of being transferred to his editor, his phone call is put live on CNN.
Yes.
And so he's basically wetting his pants on CNN. He says, "You have to bring me home." And the truly obnoxious host chuckles, "I don't think we can bring you home, Jimmy, but we are bringing you into the homes of millions of Americans."
You know, they give you these lists of phone numbers and they're like, "This is NBC, and you can call into them, and you could do BBC or CNN. But I started thinking about what could happen because I was doing a call-in and I was standing sort of beside a sand dune, and suddenly my shadow started flexing with really impressive biceps that I've never had. And suddenly the interview just sort of stopped cold because I was staring at my gesticulating shadow until I realized that there was a Marine, just a young Marine, nobody I knew, just kind of fooling around, who could tell that I was having a serious conversation. And I suddenly realized that this was sort of open-ended, that it's not the correspondent sitting in a booth. Like, you're out there and things are happening while you're talking to the country.
You've picked two topics about which there is so much national ambivalence, the war and the media. Mm-hmm. And you put together people who generally are complicated. They're neither heroes nor villains. Was the point to bring it down to some sort of human level?
I think it became that. I mean, on the one hand, this idea that Americans seem to know so much more about our celebrities than the places where our brothers and kids are fighting. And so to take not just a reporter, but a gossip columnist was something that really interested me. In a way, it's like taking America's obsession and pushing it into America's area of responsibility.
Had you written fiction before?
I had. I'd written a lot of fiction. I had been trying to craft novels actually as far back as eighth grade.
You did decide to translate this experience into fiction. Did you go there with the thought you might?
You know, after the media boot camp where they trained us all to be good observers of war, the military, the Pentagon, that is, I started playing with the idea. There was just something about the fake war that they were putting the reporters through in big groups, doing the crawl on our bellies with fake green gas all around us. I just thought this is sort of ridiculous, and everyone else seemed to be taking it so seriously. And I take it seriously as well, but the idea of sort of looking at, you know, what is grotesque about this? What is ironic or what is strange, as opposed to just kind of everybody trying to heroize themselves?
Nick, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Nick Kulish is the author of Last One In and also the New York Times Berlin Bureau Chief.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson. Paul Schneider is our engineer. We also had help from Jessica McGaldy and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for WNYC is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting the New York Philharmonic New Year's Gala with violinist Joshua Bell on December 31st, hosted by Renee Fleming. Check local PBS listings. Support for On the Media is provided by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. journalism.columbia.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.